Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Delicious Yellow podcast with me, Matthew Mills, and my wife and business partner, Ella Mills.
Hi, guys. So today we are doing something very exciting. It was actually on my birthday this year, on the 31st of May. There's some really interesting articles that came out that really caught Matt and I's attention. And the headlines were, avoiding meat and dairy is the single biggest way to reduce your impact on Earth. And that this new research shows without meat and dairy consumption, global farmland use could be reduced by more than 75%, an area equivalent to the US, China, the European Union and Australia combined, and still feed the world. And that was kind of too powerful not to get involved in our podcast. So we've driven up to Oxford today, and we're sitting in Oxford, and we are talking to Joseph Poor, who led this study on 40,000 farms. So loads to talk about.
So Joseph, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
So first of all, could you just give any listeners who aren't familiar with the study just a bit of background on it, how it came about, what went into the study, and what the top line findings were?
Yeah, sure. So we assessed the environmental impacts of 40 foods that represent about 90% of what we eat in terms of protein and calories. We did that using data from 40,000 farms in almost every country in the world. And we assessed the full food supply chain, from the deforestation and clearing of land for agriculture, right through to processing, packaging, transport, and retail.
And is that things like the water that's involved in it as well?
Yes, we looked at five environmental indicators. We looked at how much land is needed to make the food, the greenhouse gas emissions that are created, the water use, as you said, and two indicators representing the degradation of terrestrial land and water ecosystems called acidification and eutrophication.
And can you give us a bit more detail on the process and then what the findings of the study were?
What we're basically trying to do is understand not just the average impacts for different products, but the range, i.e. if you produce a product in a slightly different way, or what is the impact? So for example, the lowest impact beef is using 36 times more land and creating 6 times more greenhouse gas emissions than peas and beans.
So even, and are peas and beans particularly bad
peas
vegan
and beans,
foods?
Peas and beans are they're all relatively low. Peas and beans are some of the lowest. But you've also got tofu, which even the highest impact tofu, even if you want to get it from Brazil, for example.
Because there's been a lot of stuff in the papers about that recently, about that about soy being damaging for the environment.
Yeah, so it's first getting a few facts on the table. Most of the soy we buy in the shops in the UK to eat doesn't come from the Amazon.
Right. Where does it come from?
It can come from Europe. There's soy grown in France. And a lot of it comes from America.
Okay.
So for eating. But from the Amazon, it's mainly for animal food, animal feed.
So even for plant-based proteins that maybe have to travel a very long way and have a lot of food miles associated with them and maybe even lots of packaging with them, they would still be, in what you're saying, is more damaging than, say, locally reared beef that you buy from your local butcher.
That's right. Yeah, that's pretty much the message from our study. And so our tofu in our study includes tofu that's come from very far away. It also includes tofu that's got deforestation in the value chain. And they have lower, that even that has lower impacts than plant products. And just to go back to what we were saying, firstly, most tofu comes from Europe or the US that we eat. And secondly, most of the clearance for land, most of the land clearance for soy in the Amazon is for animal products. Something about 90% of it is for feed, particularly towards China for pig feed. So that's where this deforested soy is
so
going.
Actually, all these kind of things that have come out in the paper, I think it was in the last week or so, talking about how actually negative, therefore, vegan diet is because of the soy. Actually, the soy isn't for the vegan diet. The soy is actually for cattle.
Yeah,
so it's incredible. It kind of makes the message even more confusing.
Yeah, so, I mean, globally, if we just ate soy directly, we'd need literally a fraction of the amount of soy that we produce. And the very large majority, 80% probably globally, it's just I don't have the exact number, goes to animal feed. 90% in the Amazon is, over 90% in the Amazon is for animal feed. And particularly Chinese pig industry.
That's fascinating.
And one of the other points that you included, which I think is really interesting, because I think when people are thinking about changing the way they're living in order to have a positive impact on the environment, you know, we're quite kind of slow to think about food in other than food miles and things like that. And we're thinking, oh, we must get an electric car or something like that. But again, you said that actually changing your diet is far bigger than cutting down on your flights or buying an electric car.
Yes, that's one of the really positive things I think that came out of this study. The fact is that there are these different diets that deliver transformative benefits for the environment. And we looked at a range of diets, but one of them was a vegan diet. And we found that it would require we just modelled a global transition so you could see the numbers at scale.
If 7.7 billion people became vegan.
And obviously that scales down. I'll talk how that scales down to an individual level. But globally, we'd require 3.1 billion hectares less land to produce our food. So that's the same as the entirety of Africa we'd no longer need to farm.
Wow.
That could return to nature or reforest. So that's the first thing, is massive land.
And that would also use much less water and things like that as well. It's not simply just their land area. Because water is looking to be a real scarcity, isn't it, in the future?
Yeah, exactly. So land is one of the issues, and it cuts land use significantly. Secondly, it cuts water use by about a quarter, global water use, changing diets. And thirdly, it cuts our greenhouse gas emissions globally by about 23%. And half of that 23% is just the difference between animal products and vegetable products. The other half is the potential carbon that would be stored when trees grow on all that land that we've saved.
Right.
Thirdly, it cuts our water pollution by about 80%. Our water pollution that's caused by food by about 80%. So that's nitrogen and phosphorus going into ecosystems. And it also cuts our acidification, which is a measure of pollution of land. So you're having a big effect, not just on greenhouse gas emissions, on such a wide range of environmental indicators. And you can also look at it from as a consumer. For a UK consumer, it's probably going to cut your greenhouse gas emissions by about something between 2 and 4 tonnes per year per person. So that's bigger than that's bigger than a lot of other options that people typically consider. Diet doesn't really feature.
So some of the initiatives that are gaining a lot of traction at the moment, things like Meat Free Monday, is that enough by people just not eating meat on a Monday, or is it something where there has to really be huge systemic change for us to fix this enormous issue we're facing?
Well, here's some numbers for you. Yeah. By 2050, we're going to be consuming 1.4 trillion litres of milk. That's the forecast. And 500...
Wait, sorry, we're going to say that again. 1.4 trillion litres?
Yeah, a year of milk and 500 billion kilograms of meat. And that's a 60% increase on 2018. Wow. So it's pretty close in the future, 2050.
Yeah.
And what would be the impact of this? What to people who are listening to this and sitting here in 2018 and, you know, the sun shining and everything looks okay. In 2050, what could the world look like if that is the case and we continue on this trend?
I mean, there are a lot of things that go into a forecast, and we didn't specifically make them in our paper. But what is very clear to say is that we've already cleared about 40% of the world for farming, deforested cleared it to turn into pastures or other forms of farmland. And what we also know is that since 2000, an area of tropical forests, so the most biodiverse forests in the world, the area the size of the UK, France, Germany, Spain, and Portugal has been cut down or burnt.
In the last 18 years?
In the last 18 years. So this is...
Not even 2 decades.
No. So and we've cleared it largely for livestock grazing and livestock feed. And we did that just because people prefer the taste of animal products to vegetable products. And the last 2 years have been the highest this century on record for deforestation. And with those forecasts that I just mentioned, it's hard to see any scenario where we're not going to keep clearing land at that rate. It's hard to see any scenario where greenhouse gas emissions from the agricultural production stage don't increase, and our other impacts on our really precious planet don't keep increasing. But I think, you know, our study did highlight that there is this alternative.
Yeah, and a vegan diet.
And it really does change the impacts. That
and can we reverse the impacts that we've had to this point from that? Or is it something where we would then just kind of level off?
That's a difficult question. And we can probably reverse most of the impacts on greenhouse gas emissions if other sectors also cut. So we can avert the worst of global warming if we make some drastic changes today.
And but we're not. It doesn't look like we're doing that, does it?
Well, the UK is doing quite a good job. Our emissions have actually fallen in the UK, and some other countries, particularly in Europe, are actually doing a really good job at emissions. Probably not quite fast enough, but...
But you say that the impact on planet Earth, it's going to a vegan diet is far bigger than cutting down on your flights or buying an electric car. On what kind of scale are we talking about across those?
Well, so as an individual, this is just on carbon. So remembering that my point was about the fact that agriculture, you're not just cutting your greenhouse gas emissions, you're cutting a whole range of other indicators. Yeah. But you can also look at it on greenhouse gas emissions. So for a UK consumer, diet change is going to cut your emissions by 2 to 4 tonnes per year of carbon dioxide equivalents. That's about the same as 13 flights from the UK, from London to Copenhagen, return flights. So it's quite a lot of flying that you would cut out. Obviously, if you do a flight to Australia, you're going to blow your carbon budget. in terms of an electric car, the estimate is you'd save about 2 tonnes of carbon on buying an electric car. So it's probably bigger than that.
But it's also much more achievable than that, right?
Like, yeah.
It's much less expensive. You know, it's actually probably going to save people money rather than, you know, it's a big purchase.
Exactly. It's something that everyone can do right now. And not everyone's taking flights to Australia.
No, exactly.
But people are, everyone in any country in the world can change their diet and achieve these, you know, huge benefits, not just greenhouse gas emissions, but this wide range of
benefits. It's difficult to create policy changes for something that isn't visually in front of us today. You know, when you look at the issues facing us today, long NHS waiting lists or Brexit and how that could affect our daily lives, what do you think policymakers need to do, particularly when it looks like the changes we need to make are so severe and will probably be very unpopular? what would you suggest we need to do as a collective human being to try and fix this? Or is it something where, from what you're seeing and the trends we're on, is it something where we will just keep bumbling along and then at some point it will just break?
That's a really excellent question. And he or she who has the answer to that has nailed it. But our solution was that we need labels on products. And this is what you were saying earlier, Ella, that we don't really know when we're in the shops what we're actually buying. And if we knew that, those impacts, that would be a great start to reminding consumers, whether you're interested in the environment or not, you're daily, you're confronted with the facts every time you go to the shops.
When you hear the facts like you're sharing with us now, it's quite hard to bury your head in the sand and ignore them.
And people vote with their wallets ultimately, don't they? I mean, supermarkets, shops will supply what consumers want. And if something isn't selling, they take it off the shelf. We know that from our business. And so we are all the voters here.
One other question I had, though, which I've definitely noticed kind of with friends and family, is that I think some people who are really interested in this matter, like they've done some research into it and they've kind of appreciated that beef is not especially very good for the environment, for example. And lots of people have moved, therefore kind of maybe not having so much red meat and maybe moving towards kind of a pescatarian way of eating. But one of the things that's quite interesting in your study, which I know when I've shared it with friends and family, people have been really surprised about, and I think we were both as well quite surprised about, was this idea that actually fishing and fish is potentially not, again, the solution, and that actually fish farming especially is not so brilliant for the planet.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of surprises that came out of this study, and fish farming was one of them. So we didn't really know the true emissions of fish farming, but when you, what we put in a model, and we built a model that looked at what happens to the excreta of fish and the unconsumed feed. So when you put feed in, the fish don't eat it.
Yeah.
And the excreta
so
goes...
So this is looking at farmed fish?
Yeah, farmed fish, so which is about 50% of global fish consumption.
Okay.
So it goes to the bottom of the ponds, and it's this perfect environment for bacteria and microorganisms to convert this carbon, which is what they're converting, into methane. There's no oxygen down there, so normally you convert carbon into CO2 there, because there's no oxygen, they convert it into methane, which is really potent...
Which is what's involved in cattle farming, which is what people are saying is such a bad thing.
And so, what is so deadly, or what is so damaging about methane?
Well, it traps heat in the atmosphere, and it traps. It's more potent at doing that, and more powerful at doing that than carbon dioxide.
So that's what's raising part of what's raising global temperatures and warming the planet up.
Yeah. So the biggest contributor to global temperature rise has been carbon dioxide, and the biggest contributor has been the fossil fuel industry, which is today about 61% of our emissions. So it's very important. We shouldn't lose focus on the fossil fuel industry, but there are these other gases, methane, nitrous oxide, as well as hydrofluorocarbons, which is another one. But those methane and nitrous oxide both really come from agriculture. And as I was saying with fish farming, fish farms can actually create more methane than cows.
Wow. Okay, that's...
And when your paper came out, I know we were really shocked by it and gripped by it, and it was a topic of hot conversation around our dinner table. What have you found the reaction to be? Have you been hearing from politicians or lobbyists or anyone else who have said, wow, we didn't know this, this is something we really need to get a grip of? Or has it been something that you've seen kind of come and go, and some people have just kind of wanted to put their head in the sand on it?
I've actually had a really positive reaction, I'd say, compared to... So I've had some companies contacting me who'd like to understand more. Next week, I'm speaking to some agrochemical and agricultural companies about this, and I'm actually speaking to an EU working group about this. It's actually got politicians and businesses that actually really want to do something, and I think that's a really good sign. And I don't... You know, I just think it's got to be a combination of... More consumers are interested in, and businesses are ultimately got people.
We are all
them.
Stakeholders in this, aren't we? Yeah, this isn't something that can be fixed by one person or one group. This
yes,
ultimately
but at the
comes
same time,
to...
the thing that's interesting is that actually, again, and we did a really interesting episode a few weeks ago with someone who works in the food waste space, and it was a similar conclusion, if you can call it conclusion, which is that actually, as individuals, we can actually play such a massive part in this. And you think, I'm just one person, what does what I eat for dinner matter tonight? But actually, you know, there's 27 million households in the UK. So if 27 million households had a plant-based dinner, that would make a really big difference if we kept doing that again and again.
Can the UK, people in the UK, make that big of a difference? Or is the effects that have been felt from China and places like that...
too great?
Are they just too great for us to really be able to make any difference?
Well, there are different ways. So there's obviously consumer change, and that really matters. It has immediate impacts on the environment. It also sets an example and shows what's possible to other people. And that's really important as well. So it can spread out. But if you can do it in a really intelligent way as well, that might be a way that labelling would work. We required that food products were labelled in our country. Producers around the world who supply the food to this country would have to monitor their impacts and understand what they're doing to the environment when they produce their food. And that is basically creating information that doesn't exist, and it would allow them to reduce their impacts. So if we require producers around the world to measure their impacts, that's a kind of a smart way of expanding the benefits, you know, of our desire to do good for the planet.
And so what happened to your own diet when you were doing the study?
So I think the thing that I found particularly hard to give up was cheese.
Yeah.
And I liked those prep cheese and tomato croissants. they were my staple food for a long time, but cheese it can have a higher impact than pork and poultry. And I just, on doing this research and also actually learning about the dairy industry, which is really intensified.
Because our demand is intensified.
Our demand's so high and we want to produce at the lowest possible cost. And because, you know, half of our beef comes from the dairy industry. It's typically the lower grade beef that comes from it. So it's an industry that's trying to produce thousands of litres each year from a single cow to try and get maximum value for money and produce lots of beef from to get extra revenue. And all of this comes together to this highly intensified and effectively exploitative industry that is also having really high environmental impacts. And that was what...
And I think there was a record for a commercially reared chicken of 21 days to get to supermarket grade. Is that
right?
Yeah,
that's right. I think that was in New Zealand. But globally, across all countries, we're seeing a trend towards intensification of the additional food demand that we're going to require by 2050. About 80-90% of that will come from in highly intensive systems, and most pork and poultry around the world is intensively produced.
So then you move away from just an environmental issue to a kind of ethical issue as well, because this is becoming kind of, you know, whether you thought it was ethical in the first place to kill an animal, it's becoming, if you're shortening an animal's life cycle by kind of two-thirds or so, it feels as though you're then kind of getting into the foie gras sort of space. Yeah. No, but in all seriousness, yeah. I mean, that in itself is also quite frightening. But I think it's that we don't want to see what's happening behind closed doors. And every now and again, a kind of documentary will come out. And I think the documentaries can be quite sensationalizing, like Cowspiracy and things like that. But at the same time, they really shock people, because I think we don't want to see necessarily what's happening, because we don't want to, as individuals, make those little changes. Because, as you said, we're not doing it because people really like the taste of something, even though we're creating something that's so incredibly unsustainable for our planet. It feels like we're having the wrong conversations. If you want to look after the planet, if you want to save the world, which I think we've decided we do. You know, and it feels like at the moment, the way the media is talking about things and the way the conversations are going, you know, generally between friends, is that to save the planet, what we need to do is kind of point our fingers at restaurants who are using plastic straws and people that are using plastic straws. And plastic straws, as far as I'm aware, are kind of a fraction of ocean plastic. And the Pacific Patch has 46% of its fishing nets. And, you know, we're looking at the methane and things like that in fishing as well, in farmed fishing. And it just feels to me a little bit like we're having the wrong conversations. Like, if you want to save the fish and you want to save the planet, don't eat the fish rather than the plastic straw. And I just can't help but feel like the conversation needs to move on and people need to become aware of this. And I'd be really interested to understand from your perspective, how do we share this with people? How do we get people talking about this in a way that doesn't terrify them, in a way that doesn't kind of turn people off from the conversation?
But I think it is terrifying. I don't think that there's any way of looking at the stark reality of what we're looking at and it not be terrifying. But I think the way through it is by creating positive messages of excitement to get through it. So are there exciting innovations that are happening or new technologies that are being developed that would allow us to fix this ginormous issue? Or is it something that really is, it's the only thing that's going to change it? It's just by human beings just changing their, for starts, their eating habits.
Well, there are. One technology is obviously managing and reducing farms' impacts through digital tools and monitoring on farm and stuff like that, and labelling, food labelling. And
to give consumers a kind of very conscious choice.
Yes, there are a number of different technologies. One is labelling food and monitoring farmers' impacts through digital technology. That's interesting. I think that's one of the most powerful options we have. And other technologies might be lab-grown meat or other types of...
So you're seeing some startups, a couple in the States, I think are coming over here, one called Beyond Meat, which has the Beyond Burger.
Mm. I think that's launched here.
Yeah, which is basically...
In Honest Burgers.
Yeah, it's a burger that's basically made in a lab, and it's a plant-based burger, and it even bleeds, so you get the, you know, if that's what you want, you get all of the textures or... appearance of eating a burger made of cow. Do you think that that is a solution? Is food made in a lab the way forward?
We don't know enough about the consumer demand for this kind of stuff, nor do we know about the environmental impacts. I think they would be great things to have in our bag of ammunition to understand these different approaches. I think it's a good idea. I think if we can get consumers to change what they're consuming to a more environmentally friendly option, I think that's a good thing.
Did you say before we started, though, that there were studies where there could actually be a net greater impact from food grown in labs as well? And there's studies that that actually contradict each other, whether there are actually big benefits or not.
Yeah, there are literally a handful, maybe four studies out there that look at the environmental impacts of lab-grown meat, and one comes up with a really low impact, another one comes up with a really high impact, a bit higher than beef. So we don't really know where it's going at the moment. All you've got is information from companies. It's quite behind closed-door processes at the moment.
Yeah,
and we need to know more.
Okay, so for people listening that are now thinking, oh my gosh, this is so difficult. I did not know any of this. I do quite want to change my diet. So they're thinking about changing their diet. Doesn't matter if, you know, should we really, really be focusing on local and seasonal? So, you know, in our winter, making sure we're having the carrots and the potatoes and having that as the bulk of the meal. Or does it not matter as much to have your bananas and avocados, for example, because your net impact is so significantly lower?
I mean, seasonal is good.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. Things like avocados are probably a bit overblown in the media.
Yeah.
And I think they're actually relatively low impact.
That's good to hear, because guacamole is my favourite food.
Is it something like 6% of carbon emissions are created from food travel, is that right?
That's exactly right, yeah.
Food so miles.
Yeah, 6% of food's greenhouse gas emissions are generated by transport. It can be a lot lower for some products, but it can be quite high for some products. So what you really want to avoid is those very soft fruits that are transported very long distances. So, for example, raspberries from Peru, they're going to be quite high impact. They're still, if you're having them in moderation, it's like anything, it's probably not going to be that.
So a raspberry, say, from Peru, which is on the bad end of the scale. Because it's come on a plane and it has high greenhouse gas emissions compared to, say, meat that's grown and a mile down the road. How do they compare? Because obviously, first of all, on just a greenhouse gas emission perspective, but then also throughout the whole of the rest of the chain that we're looking at.
Yeah, so raspberries from Peru are a soft fruit transported by air to the UK, could have the same emissions as something like pork. So they can actually be quite high impact. But that's just greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah,
so food miles are just a greenhouse gas emission issue. You're not talking about land use. You're not talking about water use and the pollution of terrestrial and aquatic ecosystems. So it's just a single indicator issue. But the food miles have definitely been blown up a bit in the media.
That's what I was going to say. It feels like we've picked on a few topics that make it more comfortable for us potentially as consumers to point our finger at the guacamole or something like that, because I'm just choosing guacamole because I love it, so I want to defend it. But
avocados will come by boat, which is very low emission.
That is brilliant. I'm very happy about that. But what's interesting to me is I feel like, again, looking at that kind of whether we're having the right conversation, it feels whenever I say something about a vegan diet to someone, literally the first thing they come back at me at is the avocado or something like that, and the food miles involved in that. And would it be right to say that potentially that isn't necessarily looking at the problem, not necessarily in the wrong way or the right way, but it's looking at the whole picture in a singular way rather than
as a multidimensional way.
Yeah, so there are all sorts of things we can do to change and make our lifestyles and make what we eat and at lower impact, as you were saying, seasonal, you know, avoiding things that have been transported for a very long way, but they all ignore the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
So say, and that is meat and animal products.
And fish.
And farmed fish and fish from the oceans. Fish from the oceans is the real problems, environmental problems, there are to do with the over-exploitation of fish stocks. And some fish are virtually completely depleted.
But they can come back. I mean, I think it was...
If we stop.
Yeah, I think if we stop. So all we just manage it properly. So I think cod fishing in the North Sea, they got back to, down to levels, I think it was about 15 years ago, where there were kind of no cod. And then over the last 15 years, they've been managed. They're now back to completely sustainable levels.
So, but that's because we've been farming the cod now. And what we've learning is that farming the fish is not a good thing for the environment. So yes, if we stop eating it full stop, but moving from one to the other isn't necessarily dealing with the wider issue outside of the sole cod population of our environment as a whole.
Exactly. So when you just look at it on fish stocks in the North Sea, it looks like you fixed the issue.
But you didn't. Exactly. You just moved the problem elsewhere. Yeah, exactly. But the positive, as far as we're understanding from you today, is we can fix the issue, but we have to make the decision now in ourselves, in our communities, with our friends and family, that we are going to change our diets.
Yeah, there are two things that I think we need to do. Firstly, we need to globally reduce our consumption of animal products. That is such a key driver of the food.
And is it just animal products in food, or is it animal products in fashion?
Yeah, is leather and things like that involved in that?
Well, yeah, they all it's all part of the same system.
Is food a bigger contributor than the fashion industry
says? Yeah, food is a bigger contributor than fashion by a long way. For me, there are two things that we need to do. Firstly, globally, worldwide, we need to significantly reduce our consumption of animal products. And secondly, to go to all the points and the discussions and we've been having here, we need labels, we need environmental information on our food products. So instead of having wild debates in the media or people not knowing, it just says it there. You've got the facts when you're in the shops. That's what the impact is.
But it can't just be greenhouse gas emissions, right? It needs to be looking at all five factors you mentioned, because otherwise, again, we're getting a skewed picture on things.
Exactly.
And how far away do you think we are from having that labeling?
I hope it's within 5 years, possibly around there. That's my hope, and we're doing research on that at the moment here in Oxford. And there are a lot of companies out there. The EU's done a big project on labeling, and there are a lot of companies out there that are actually really engaged with this. And I see it as a way to not just put information on products, but have a positive effect on the whole food system, where you create information, i.e. farmers know what their impacts are and they can change it.
Yes.
And you've seen this with energy labeling. We put energy labels on things like fridges and freezers in 1992. And the energy efficiency of all those appliances has radically changed. We don't even need labels anymore, because most things are ranked A++ and A++. So it's just been a huge transformation, and it works.
Yeah.
It works on the consumer end, it works on the producer end, and we need it in food. However, you know, that's what our research has been trying to really say, that we didn't really have the scientific information. Now we're getting there.
So for someone who eats, you know, what someone might consider a normal diet, they have meat and a couple of veg in the evening and maybe a ham sandwich for lunch, and what can they do if they can't go cold turkey vegan overnight, but they want to start making positive changes? What is a practice that you think people could try and do each week that would really start to move the needle and improve these issues that we're facing?
Well, firstly, cut out the beef. That's going to have a really big impact.
So just if
cold
you can,
turkey,
so
cold beef,
cold turkey on beef,
cold beef,
change it with something else. Secondly, try different products, and you know, there are 20, 30 different types of plant milk out there. Try them, and that's going to be
which
important.
Is the best one. I know other readers will ask, which is the best one for the environment?
The lowest impact is probably somewhere between soy and oat milk.
Nice. Oat froth is very well, as anyone's listening is worried about their latte. Oat really does froth.
Yeah, so they're probably out of the ones we looked at in our database. So there are new oats like hemp and stuff. They're exciting. They may.
But of the commonplace ones?
The commonplace ones, soy and oat.
Are really, but it sounds really like, I mean, even the worst plant milk, how does it compare to a dairy milk?
Yeah, so we looked at soy. Even the worst soy milk uses less land, creates fewer emissions than the best, the least impactful cow's milk. So, try some different milks. And then, you know, it's a gradual transition. You've just got to have some you know, it's a bit of discipline. Yeah. And realize it's only really a small taste difference. It's just the impacts of your choices.
But it has
so
to be
big.
Positive, and this is what, you know, at Delicious Yellow, what our company mission is, to try and make vegetables cool. Yeah. And people are only going to do it if it tastes great, it's aspirational, it sounds as delicious and as fun as eating a big piece of steak that's, you know, has been the thing that you go out to eat and celebrate with. And so it's only going to happen if it's really, really delicious. And that is our task every single day.
We've got to change the preconception so that when you say vegan food, someone thinks yum.
Great that you guys, as, you know, people in the food space, are trying to make the taste of vegetable proteins better. Yeah. And that's part of it. But consumers have also got to come a little, have got to change their demands and their expectations.
Totally.
And then we reach that happy zone where things taste better, consumers' expectations have changed a bit.
And the world's a healthier place.
But taste buds just change. Amazing. I started eating a lot less meat actually before I met Ella. And it's amazing how your taste buds just change. You just lose the craving that you used to have. And it only takes, if you cut out red meat, I found this, if you cut out red meat for a month or so, you just completely and utterly lose the craving. And it actually then becomes something that you just don't really want to eat. Something
you
that's
tried
kind
it
of,
again, and then you were like, ooh.
Yeah, but you just don't really want to eat something that's kind of bloody and fatty. You're just like, oh, no, I don't really want that. And it's amazing how once you make that change, you do not miss it. And this comes from someone who I used to really enjoy eating red meat. And so it really does. I hope I'm living proof of that.
Yeah, in China, you get the most delicious fresh soy milk that's hot in the morning. And
oh, really?
You really, it doesn't taste anything like the soy milk you get in the UK. And they've tried to then introduce dairy milk into China. And the Chinese consumers are actually like, you know, what we've got is actually really good.
It's a good little example.
So, yeah, so it's great to have it the other way around.
Well, honestly, we can't thank you enough for imparting so much wisdom.
Yeah, well, thanks very much for having me on.
Oh, it's the biggest pleasure in the world, honestly. And also, so cool to come to Oxford University.
Yeah,
as well. Feeling very clever. We ask every guest at the end of each episode what their kind of one practice they live by every day that helps them create a kind of healthier, happier life. And just for context, for some people that's meditation, for other people that's a daily walk, for other people it's a kind of saying or just something they've introduced in their life that makes them happy.
I keep a diary and I log what I said I was going to do.
Nice.
How I achieved it and if I didn't. And I also just log general thoughts. I think a diary.
And that's how Delicious Yellow started, was just by basically creating a journal, right? And you just wanted something that would make sure that you were tracking what you were doing every day, keeping yourself committed, and look where it's led.
Yeah, totally. And I kept a diary a long time and I always found it a really powerful tool as well. I love talking, but talking to yourself is particularly impactful. Thank you. Thank you so much.
No problem. It's been a huge pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening, guys. A lot of food for thought there. And please do come back next Tuesday. And if you liked it, please do rate, review it. And please do share this episode with your friends, because we think it's a very important topic.
Thanks, guys.